Welcome everyone to the latest edition of Talking Data. I'm your host, Kristen Radish with Arbor Research and Trading, joined today by our commentator, Jim Bianco of Bianco Research. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Today, Jim discusses managing fixed income in a world with yield. Jim, what's going on with interest rates?
Yeah, so it is a very interesting story. I would like to start off by mentioning my friend Jim Grant of Grant's Interest Rate Observer. And he likes to say it's nice to have an interest rate to observe again because we've definitely got yield.
Yes.
And that has definitely changed things. And how it's changed it is from 2009 to about 2021. The funds rate was effectively zero. There was a couple of points in there in 2018 when the Fed raised rates. Interest rates were down around 1 or 2%. And if you were a fixed income manager, you were managing for capital gains. You know, you weren't there for the yield. You were there to try and time the market and buy bonds before the prices went up and sell bonds or underweight them before the price went down. Now, you could argue you're still doing the same thing today, but you've got a big yield, and that's what's changed. So let's go to the first chart. And the first chart basically shows 200 years or so, 225 years of 10-year yields. And I put on the chart the red lines that there's usually big long cycles in bonds, you know, somewhere around 40-ish or 45 years. And you could see from the August 2020 low, which was 0.5%, 51 basis points, it looks like we've finally broken the 40-year cycle in bonds. And that 40-year cycle in bonds has been excruciating for bond investors. If we go to the next chart, this data comes from Ed McQuarrie over at Santa Clara University, as the previous data did. He's done a great job of putting together a bunch of total return and yield data. And it's a rolling 3-year total return, rolling 3-year on nominal. So that means before inflation is included in there, on total bonds. So in 2022, your 3-year total return would have lost you 26% on long-term bonds. You got to go back to 1842, and that is not a typo, to find a period that has been that bad for bonds, 160 odd years or so, 180 years actually, to find a period worse than this for bonds. So that whole end of the cycle raising of interest rates has been horrible for bond investors. And as such, a lot of people, like the kid nihilistic millennials, and maybe that's a redundant term, are sworn off bonds. That's it. They're useless instruments and I'll never want to invest in them again. Well, I get it. They just produced you the worst period to own them in 180 years. But that period is over. So if we go to the next chart, this shows two popular yields. One of them in orange is the 3-month treasury yield. It's at 5.3%. You could see that period from 2014 and then again from 2020 to 2022 when they were effectively zero. And then the blue line on the chart shows the Bloomberg aggregate index. For those that are old enough to remember, that used to be Barclays, that used to be Lehman Brothers, and now Bloomberg owns it. And that's at 4.86%. So now the yield in the bond market is around 5%. It's not around zero or one. And that makes an enormous difference when managing bond and portfolios, because now you're managing to protect that yield and maybe augment that yield. Whereas, you know, before what you were basically buying was low beta versions of stocks, low beta being not as volatile as stocks. And you were just speculating on the price because that was pretty much the only way you were going to get any kind of return. So this does change the equation. So if we go to the next chart comes from the book Stocks for the Long Run. Dr. Jeremy Siegel, in conjunction with Jeremy Schwartz, two Jeremys, wrote the update version of this book last year. So they show the annualized returns of asset classes from 1802 to 2021. Stocks annualized returns were 8.4%, bonds were 5, bills were 4. Well, now, you know, during that 2020 to 2022 period, it was hallmarked by a lot of people saying the word TINA. There is no alternative. you've got to put your money in stocks. What are you going to do? You're going to stay in bonds with a zero yield or 1% yield? No, but now, after that brutal sell-off, now all of a sudden the yield on bonds is 5%, and that's where their annualized return is. Now, of course, total return also includes price changes. If the price goes up or down, that's going to either take away from the 5% or add to it, but at least you're starting back at 5%. For the first time in about 15 or 20 years, the bond market is definitely back in the game. So we go to the final chart on this sequence. You know, this is going to be a big deal for people to try and get their head around because of this whole TINA argument. Here is money market funds. They're yielding the same as T-bills, but they should because they own T-bills, 5.31%, and that's the top chart. And the bottom chart shows you the total assets in money market funds is now over $6 trillion, up from $4.5 trillion 18 months earlier. So what's going on with interest rates because of this rethink in the market is interest rates are now competitive. And you don't hear the word TINA anymore. But I think that that's part of the motivation that a lot of people have. The Fed's got to cut rates. The Fed's got to cut rates. Because they're providing competition to bonds. Bonds are providing competition to stocks. If the Fed were to cut rates, bring these rates down, then that $1.5 trillion that went into money market funds will seek a better return. Now, it's not going to jump from a money market fund to NVIDIA calls, but it will jump from a money market fund to short-term bonds. And then the short-term bond people will jump to medium-term bonds, and the medium-term bond people will jump to equities, and the equity people will jump to riskier equities, and everybody shifts to the right, and then that pushes more money in the stock. So the first thing is that yields are up. It was brutal to get here. And now that we're here, it's changed the dynamics of portfolio management.
So, Jim, given that, what is your outlook?
Yeah, so let's go to the next chart. And the next chart, let's talk about where we are in terms of the economy. So this is Bloomberg's survey of 2024 GDP. They ask 70 economists in real time, just keep updating your forecast. That's why the chart looks the way it does. The black line is the U.S. Economists all year have been looking at the data and they've been increasing their forecast for the U.S. All the other colored lines are all the other major countries of the world, Japan, Canada, Eurozone, United Kingdom, and Germany. As the Sesame Street song goes, one of these doesn't look like the other. The U.S. does not look like everybody else. Its growth is surging while everybody else's is struggling. Why? Let's go to the next chart. Go to the next chart. What this basically shows us is consumption. So how much are people consuming? Black line again is the U.S. It's surging. We are consuming more stuff. The rest of the world is not. So why is growth so high right now? Growth is so high because we are consuming a lot more. I've explained this in the past, is that when you have a recession or a financial crisis, you immediately have a shock to the system and things change. Coming out of this, out of the shutdowns from COVID, people are spending more money in the United States. Now, we don't know why, but we could guess. And my guess is because we mailed them, you know, months worth of income or thousands of dollars in order to keep the economy going. So coming out of that, people are like, okay, why do I need to save as much when I could spend it on things and services and experiences and enjoy my life? Well, what happens when things go bad again? The government will mail me money. They did the last time. That's probably not a bad assumption on their part. So the reaction to the shutdown restart in the United States was more spending than we've seen in the rest of the world. And that's what's been driving the economy stronger. So my outlook is very, very strong growth.
Okay. We want to turn next, Jim, to talk about how hard is it to beat a benchmark?
Yeah. So when you're talking about the typical way that managers manage portfolios, they're usually gauged against a benchmark. And bonds and equities are very different. So if we go to the next chart, this comes from the SPIVA. It's called S&P Investment versus index versus active, SPIVA, S&P index versus active report. SPIVA is, it's available online, and it shows you the measurements of the percentage of funds that are underperforming their benchmark for all domestic funds. This is equities, S&P 500, and all large cap S&P 1500, and all large cap S&P 500. You'll notice that the underperformance, especially when you get 3, 5, 10 years, is 80 to 90%. So 80 to 90% of equity managers underperform their index. Now, why is that? Lots of reasons, but the big one that everybody understands is your biggest weightage, your Magnificent Seven stocks, your NVIDIAs, your Metas, your Amazons, your Googles, your Apples, are your all-stars. If you're not fully invested in these companies to the extent that your index is, the Mag 7 is 30% of the S&P. So you better have 30% of your money in these seven stocks. Well, the problem with active managers is, by most accepted standards of valuation, these companies are overvalued, and they usually don't have 30% in overvalued companies like this, and they fall behind and they underperform. And the perception is, see, no one can beat an index ever anywhere, so don't ever invest with active managers because they just underperform the index. There's a case to be made about that, as these numbers show, with equities. If we jump to the next table, that's not the case with fixed income. So here is investment grade funds, which is measured by the Bloomberg Aggregate Index, and general bond funds, which is the IBEX Dollar Index overall, which is very similar. It's almost identical to the Bloomberg Aggregate Index. And you'll notice, I see less than 50% numbers for 1 year, for 5 years, even for 3 years on the general bond funds. In other words, a majority of fixed income managers can beat the index. Index fixed income is a little bit different. Now, why is that? Well, if your problem, if your all-stars are your biggest weightings in fixed income, they're your problem children. Your companies that borrow too much money, countries that are over-leveraged, the inverted yield curve, screens of this stuff says, danger, Will Robinson, don't own this stuff, and you don't, and you tend to outperform. So beating an index in fixed income land is much more doable than it is in equity land, as witnessed by these numbers. Add to that, the yield curve is inverted. So as a fixed income manager shortens their duration, meaning that they become less sensitive to price movements to try and protect that 5% yield, they're buying shorter term bonds versus longer term bonds, and they have a higher yield. And so they're getting paid to shorten their duration as well. And that's what you're seeing a lot of within fixed income investing.
Jim, how's the index done?
So if we jump to the next level, next chart here, we do manage the Bianco Research Total Return Fixed Income Index. You can find out more about it at biancoadvisors.com. And there is an ETF that tracks our index that is put out by WisdomTree called the WisdomTree Bianco Total Return Fund, WTBN. So I'm gonna talk about the index. So our index is a factor-based index where we tilt or overweight or underweight five different factors. And I'll talk about those factors in a second. As of, the day we're recording, March 27th, we've been outperforming the benchmark index by 41 basis points. Now, you can look at our blue line and say, yes, but you're down on the year. Yeah, we're just not as down as much as the Bloomberg aggregate is. But with that big fat yield, there's going to be, 5% in the bond market. There's going to be that continued upward pull on both our index and the Bloomberg aggregate index, because we're always fully invested and we're seeking to tilt to outperform a benchmark. And the reason I went through that other section is, you can make the case that beating a benchmark in equities is difficult because 90% can't, but it's more like a coin toss in fixed income because of the various natures of the fixed income market.
What is the current positioning?
Yeah, so let's talk about that. We jump to the next chart here. We have five factors that we consider when we do our positioning. And those are duration. And as it says, we're 90%. So we look at what the benchmark, what a benchmark is, a neutral portfolio, and we're less than that. We're less sensitive to the price of bonds. So if the price of bonds is falling, meaning higher interest rates, we don't fall as much. We're fully invested. We don't short, we don't use leverage. So we're 90% duration. The yield curve. I think the yield curve is going to continue to steepen, probably towards zero, from minus 40 basis points to your 10-year yield by the end of the year. But the reality is the yield curve is so flat that if we were to barbell, meaning barbelling means we're betting on a more inverted curve by owning a bunch of 2-year notes and 30-year bonds with a target duration, or bulleted, which means we own a bunch of 5, 7, 9-year bonds with the same duration. The bulleted portfolio would benefit if the curve steepens. The barbell portfolio would benefit if the curve flattens. Doesn't matter. That the math works out that if you bullet or you barbell, unless you tell me that there's going to be this massive hundreds of basis point move in the yield curve, it's going to come out about the same either way, which is why we're neutral. We're just neutral. I think the curve's going to steepen. We should be a little bit barbelled, and technically we are a little bit barbelled, but we're really close enough that I think it's better described as neutral, largely because if we are bulleted or barbelled and it does one or the other, it's not going to change. Corporates, in January, we went a 90% underweighting in corporates. That was after record bond issuance and a big rally in stocks, thinking that the corporate market might be near an interim peak. Now, that hasn't worked, but it hasn't hurt us that much. But I still am going to hold that position, thinking that there is probably going to be some kind of a correction in the corporate bond market and see spreads maybe widen out a little bit. Securitization, we're underweight too, but we've been there for several months. And that's because what drives securitization is mortgage-backed securities. Mortgage-backed securities, every one of them has an option to prepay. So they do track volatility in the bond market. And volatility had been very, very high, and that had been a very profitable trade for us. We're still underweight, but we're probably nearing the end of it. We're still there now. But I could see in the next 3, 4, 5 months, us moving probably to an equal weight or an overweight, because as volatility comes down in the bond market, as the yield curve steepens, that should help securitization. So we're gonna stick with our underweight for a little bit longer here before we start moving it more towards neutral or potentially an overweight. And then we have a fifth section called conviction bets. And the conviction bets are out of the index, and they're limited to 20% of the portfolio. We have two of them. 10% is in short-term tips, 0 to 5-year tips, and 10% of them is long the dollar on a dollar bullish trade. So if we go to the final chart, we buy ETFs. We buy other ETFs. There are over 600 fixed income ETFs with almost $1 trillion of assets. If you look at our current list of ETFs and you were to ask me, how many individual bonds make up that list? It's 2,900 bonds is what it is. The ETFs make it much more cost efficient, especially when you're doing factor type of work like we're doing, in order to position a portfolio, as opposed to the expense, which we'd have to pass on in our index, and WisdomTree would pass on as higher fees, I would presume, if we had to buy 2,900 individual bonds. So here's our weighting, here's the actual positioning that we own. So you can see that the biggest position is MBS at 22%, 22.75, but that's actually underweighted because it should be about 24, 25% if it was an equal weight to our benchmark. And so you could see how we're positioned up and down the line. And our newest position is that third one, the WisdomTree Bloomberg USD Bullish Fund, which basically is an ETF that buys forward contracts and has the yield, buys forward contracts on the dollar. So if the dollar rallies, the ETF goes up. It has treasury bills as its margin. So you get the 5% yield plus whatever yield you get on the dollar index. So you get a big yield of about 6.75%, which is pretty good. And our thinking here is that the dollar is going to continue to rally if the economy stays strong and interest rates stay up. So, you know, if it's a bear market in bonds, why do I want to own bonds? Because there's a yield, and that yield will continue to pull prices up. And I could credibly make the case to you, now I've been very vocal that I think that the 10-year yield could go to 5% this year, or maybe a little bit higher. But I can also make the case to you that in that happening, you will also have a positive total return in the bond market, even with that occurring. And if we continue to position correctly and continue to separate ourselves from the index, and the keywords are if, and we continue to, and then, you know, as it does that pull up, we'll get pulled up even faster as well. And ETFs are very, very efficient tools right now to use in order to structure a portfolio because there's so many of them. This is fairly new in the fixed income market to do this. It's not so much new in the equity market because there's thousands of them in the equity markets, and equity managers have been using them to position portfolios for a lot longer. But slicing and dicing of the bond market is finally catching up.
Jim, thank you for your thoughts today, and thank you everyone for joining us. If you have any questions on Arbor Research, Bianco Research, or Arbor Data Science, you can contact us by emailing Gus Handler at gus.handler@arborresearch.com. Thanks again, and have a great day.